Presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, I guess we saw the consequences of the interrelatedness of the world yesterday, but that would be one way to spin it. Another would be to say, well, one of the things that was pointed out yesterday, in fact, by Jim Cramer, on, I believe he was talking to Chris Matthews, was that back 20, 30 years ago, before all of this free trade madness, not his description, mine, the United States imported 30% of the world's raw copper and made it into things. We made computers in this country. We made televisions in this country. We made radios in this country. And then we sold those electronics all over the world. China only imported 10% of the world's copper. Now China imports 30% of the world's copper and makes all that stuff, and we only import 10% of the world's copper. China's stock market gets a cold. We start sneezing, as we saw yesterday with the 400-point drop in the trade market, in the stock market. Is that a symptom of something larger? Is a gap, this trade gap, this difference between what we buy and what we sell, a good thing or a bad thing? Jim Dorn is with us. He is the editor of the Cato Journal, the Cato Institute, Cato, C-A-T-O.org. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jim, in your article here, it was actually, I guess, written by Dan Griswold, but it's the headline is Bad News on the Trade Deficit Often Means Good News on the Economy. And the second paragraph says, in fact, an analysis of economic data from the last quarter century shows that a growing current account deficit, that's the trade deficit, the are buying more stuff from the world than we're selling to the world, so they end up with a lot of our dollars, as a percentage of GDP, is actually associated with faster, not slower, economic growth, as well as rising manufacturing output and falling unemployment. You want to try and explain that?
Well,
this makes no sense to me.
What Dan's probably trying to say there is basically, as U.S. Wealth and growth increase, our demand for both domestic goods and foreign goods increases. So we're going to be able to import more goods and services from abroad when we're growing rather than when we have a recession.
We're talking about the current account deficit. We're talking about the trade deficit.
That's right.
And what you guys are suggesting is that if you look at the last 25 years, the trade deficit has gone up massively as a consequence of I'd say, by and large, our trade policies, NAFTA, CAFTA, the WTO, all this kind of stuff, GATT. And as a consequence, we're borrowing enormous amounts of money to buy all this stuff. I mean, over a 25-year period, if you borrow a lot of money, I mean, in 2001, when Bush came into office, we were borrowing $690,000 a minute from the rest of the world just to buy stuff. We're not talking about the federal deficit. We're talking about the trade deficit. This is us against the rest of the world. Last year, we were borrowing $1,450,000 per minute. So we're borrowing that money and then from China, and then we're buying stuff from China with that money. And it looks like things are better, but we're $9 trillion. You know, we're trillions of dollars in debt. China's sitting on $1 trillion worth of our paper.
Well, you know, last year we ran a record deficit, the fifth year in a row that we ran a record deficit, and it was over $750 billion.
Right. And I just don't understand how Cato can come out and say that that's a good thing.
Well, China accounted for a little over $200 billion of that, and the other was accounted for with Japan, the EU, Canada, and Mexico. In fact,
and a fair amount of oil.
Right. And our biggest trade partners are actually Canada and Mexico.
And the biggest imports that we have from them are oil and wood, by and large.
And there's other things, too, but... you know, I think Japan for over a decade had zero growth and deflation, and they were running a big trade surplus. So whether you run a trade surplus or a deficit, you've got to look at the whole picture.
Their trade surplus had nothing to do with their lack of growth. That had to do with internal monetary policy. I mean, they were running, you know, a very tight money monetary policy in China. That
You know, you mean Japan.
Or Japan, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But if a country has slow economic growth, that means that we're not going to be able to afford as many imports. So imports would fall and our exports would rise relative to that. So
right, but we're not talking about growth here. We're talking about borrowing. Let me just tell you what it sounds to me like you guys are doing, Jim, and I'll just lay it out in the most kind of gross way possible, and you can tell me if I'm crazy or not. It seems to me that what you're doing is rationalizing an economic policy of let's borrow money from the rest of the world and spend that money and call that prosperity, when in fact what we're doing is inflicting on our children and our grandchildren massive amounts of debt. And this is a conscious policy. It's bipartisan. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT pushed that stuff through. Clinton and Bush Sr. both argued with Ross Perot. He warned us about this. Reagan started pushing this stuff. This Thomas Friedman World is Flat Kool-Aid has been drunk by so many people over the last 25 years. And I thought it was particularly ironic that your news release says an analysis of economic data from the last quarter century, that is right back to Reagan, shows that as our debt goes up, so does our economic growth. And yeah, of course. I mean, you give me a credit card with a $10 million credit limit, I'll show you what it looks like to live large, particularly if I know that my grandchildren are going to have to pay for it.
Well, you know, I think we should distinguish two things. When we trade with people or with countries, as long as it's voluntary, there's got to be a win-win situation.
Why?
When we trade with our grocer. I mean,
why can't there be a win-lose situation?
Well, that doesn't happen with trade, or else we can always back out. I mean, the U.S. consumers have gained tremendously. You know, it's like a huge amount of foreign aid to us. If foreign governments want to, you know, send us real goods and services and resources, when they get little pieces of paper, you know, plus government IOUs back, that's a good deal for American consumers.
Well, sort of, but here's the problem. Those IOUs, that paper, those dollars that they have, or that debt that they have, the only place they can spend that is in the United States because it's denominated in dollars. And so now they come into the United States and they buy our businesses. You know, and as a consequence of that, we've got, you know, 90% of our audio equipment business in the United States now is foreign owned. Our leather products, 90%, computer equipment, 79%, apparel, 75%, commercial and service industrial machinery, 58%. You've got foreign companies and foreign governments in many cases, you know, Dubai wanting to buy our ports, coming in and they're saying, hey, we've got all these extra dollars because America's running a trade deficit, so we're sitting on all these dollars. What are we going to do with them? Let's buy America. So we're giving away our country. We're selling off our country piece by piece to have this phony prosperity and cheap stuff in Walmart. And the consequence of that is not only a security consequence, but there's also an economic one in that if I now work for a company, well, for example, one of my publishers is Random House. They published three books of mine. Random House is actually owned by Bertelsmann in Germany. So if I make profit for Random House, that profit doesn't stay in the United States. It goes to Germany. How does that help America?
Well, you've got to recognize that, you know, if you look at job losses caused by trade, China only accounts for about 1% of all job displacement in the United States. Most of it is due to increased productivity in manufacturing, new technology, changes in consumer preferences.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about job loss. I'm talking about us going in debt to the rest of the world.
Well, you know,
then them using that debt to buy us. We're going to end up with America not being owned by Americans anymore.
Well, you know, Japan invested a lot of money in the United States when they had a roaring economy and so forth, and most of those investments crashed for them. They weren't very profitable.
Well, a lot of them are back now because most of them were in real estate. A lot of them are back now, but the Japanese were doing that again because we had a trade deficit with them, and that, I think many of us would argue it's not really a good thing that Japan own, you know, a large chunk of our motion picture industry, for example,
the thousands of workers that work for Toyota in the United States are pretty happy with the employment.
They're happy to get the paycheck, but when Toyota makes a profit, that profit goes to Japan. It doesn't go to the United States to build the United States. I mean, if an American company makes a profit, then they grow in the United States.
U.S. investors own, you know, stock in Toyota and other companies as well. So,
but not a majority of it.
It's probably sitting in some portfolios with union members, I assume. But in any event, you know, the trade deficit also reflects the fact that we're saving more domestically than we're investing, and we're borrowing, you know, to make up the difference. But it also reflects the U.S. government fiscal deficit. And if you want to talk about borrowing, that bothers me a lot more, that the U.S. because trade is voluntary, but the government spending is not voluntary. That's raised by taxes or future taxes, which is
Two separate issues, and I'd be glad to have that as a separate discussion with you. But I'd suggest to you, Jim, that trade is not voluntary. Trade is the result of the rules of the game, and that the rules of the game were very different before Clinton signed WTO and NAFTA. They were very different before Bush 1 was demanding fast track than they are now.
Well, I don't know. Nobody's forcing the U.S. consumers to buy from abroad. They're buying because they have a comparative advantage and the lower cost. Now, you could argue that the foreigners are artificially lowering the value of their currency by currency manipulation. I don't buy that argument, but that is...
Yeah, neither do I, frankly.
That's a legitimate argument. Or foreigners... You know, we complain because the Chinese don't let us come into their markets.
I think they're protecting them. Jim, we got to wrap it up, but it's a good conversation. Thanks for starting it off with us. Cato.org, the website. Jim Doran with Cato Institute. 16 minutes.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Say gives me the right to say my say, and I've got a few opinions to disperse. About all the changes that I see, direct effect on you and me, some are for the better, some for worse. Trade deficit has me upset with our ever-increasing debt, loss of our manufacturing base. Scores of American industries are being sold out overseas, and foreign companies taking our place. Remember Lucent and RCA, they were born and bred in the USA. They've learned to parlez-vous français, that's real. And even IBM PCs passed on to the Red Chinese and 500 patents part of the deal. And Westinghouse abilities with nuclear facilities recognized throughout the global span. And it's so hard to determine just how Chrysler became German and why Westinghouse sold out. To Japan,
indeed. I welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Here, this is incredible. And this, you know, the stock market crash yesterday, or the stock market hiccup yesterday. It really wasn't a crash. It was a burp. But it indicates a weakness in the system, which indicates a fundamental insanity that has been pervading the American economy and the American political scene, frankly, for the last 26 years. And I am concerned that nobody's talking about this. And I think nobody's talking about it, frankly, because most people don't understand it. So I just want to lay it out in really simple terms. Not as if I assume that people are dumb or anything, but I know everybody's busy. We've got a million things to do. We're trying to raise families. We're trying to make it through life. The news media doesn't talk about this because it doesn't have to do with Anna Nicole Smith. But this is real stuff. There are two ways that this nation is going badly into debt, but really three ways. The third way is consumer debt. You and I, mortgages, you know, we're student loans, buying cars on time. The average American is deeper in debt than they ever have been in the past, and that puts us individually at risk. Then there's the larger national debt. There's two ways that a nation goes into debt. The first way is by the government spending money that it doesn't have, and so it has to borrow that money. It borrows that money by issuing IOUs called treasury bills or treasury bonds, treasury notes, and they're IOUs. And people buy them, and you know, wealthy people like the Bush family put them in their trust fund. You know, when George Bush was born, he had millions of dollars in treasuries in his trust fund and like that kind of thing, you know, the Bush girls and whatnot. Because it's a safe, you know, it's backed by the full faith of the U.S. government, but it's an IOU. So the government, the federal government, goes into debt. Now our debt has got so bad. Now, when I was a kid, I remember back in the 50s and 60s as a child, you know, I mean, in elementary school in the late 1950s, they came in and we would put quarters and dimes into these little cards to buy government IOUs, to buy, what were they called? They're bonds, government bonds, I-bonds. No, the I-bonds are the new ones. In any case, they were these IOUs from the government, and that we would make a profit on. And it was a way of having we, the people, invest in our own government. We all felt kind of cool about it. You know, we're helping out the government. We're loaning money to the government. You know, we're helping win the Cold War, whatever it was. But it got so bad that instead of having kids invest, I mean, after Reagan came into office and said, you know, I can just borrow like crazy. I can and spend like a drunken sailor, with all, you know, due appreciation to drunken sailors, or no insult intended, and just spend like crazy. And as long as nobody notices that I'm borrowing, then I can make it look like the economy's good, and I can get reelected. I can get Republicans elected, and everything will be fine. And so Reagan ran up more debt. Reagan spent money and borrowed money, more so than all other presidents, from George Washington to Ronald Reagan, combined. That's how bad it was. And he borrowed that money in your name and mine. Now, that's federal debt. Now, the first president to double what Reagan has, almost double what, to beat Reagan, is George W. Bush. He's borrowed even more money than Ronald Reagan. So now we are in debt to the rest of the world to the tune of $9 trillion. And the Chinese are sitting on $1 billion of that, and et cetera. I mean, it goes all around the place. You know, but the second way that we go into debt is we buy stuff as a nation, as consumers. We buy things from other countries, and we don't have anything that they want to buy. We don't sell them anything. Because we don't make things here anymore because of these insane trade policies that did away with tariffs and said, oh, it's fine to move your manufacturing overseas. It's fine to move your service industries overseas. It's fine to do your accounting in India. It's no problem you make your shoes in China. That's no problem. And so we're buying the things that used to be made in the United States from other countries. We're giving them dollars. And we don't make anything that they want anymore. We've gone from being the largest exporter of finished goods in the world when Ronald Reagan came into office, which is the definition of a first world country. We were the largest importer of raw materials, the largest exporter of finished goods. We brought in ore, we shipped out televisions and computers. We've gone from that to being the exact opposite. We are now the largest importer of finished goods in the world and the largest exporter of raw materials. We now are being strip mined by other countries, companies in other countries, to get the raw materials to make things to sell to us. And we're in debt to them. And as a result, they're coming in and buying us up. America is losing its quality as America. We're no longer America anymore. And moving faster and faster in that direction. We have to do something about it. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
I'm born and bred in the USA, and what's gone wrong since my heyday and the nature of the problems that we face? America the supplier became America the buyer, losing our world preeminent place. When Zenith was the Zenith, a proud American name, it meant the tip of the top, the cream of the crop, the best name in the game. Quality, technology, American know-how slipped away from the USA and belongs to Korea now.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat right up at the top of the page. There's also a blog over at airamericaradio.com, although I'm in the live chat room all day, every day. Well, not all day, every day. While I'm on the air, six hours a day, every day. Tomorrow, just a reminder, tomorrow and Friday, I will be broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. They put out an email notice to all the talk show hosts. I'm on You know, I give $5 a year to the Republican National Committee to get on their list, and I'm on all the lists for the right-wing talking points every day. I could tell you every day. In fact, often we do. We do these, you know, behind enemy line segments. Here's what the right-wing talking points are going to be for the day. Usually you know them by the time I get on the air because you've already heard them six times. But in any case, so they sent out this thing inviting talk show hosts from all over America to come and meet with and listen to speakers, including and interview some of the more the luminaries, the conservative luminaries. If you go to CPAC.org, you can see 34th Annual Conservative Political Action Conference. 2007 invited speakers, Vice President Dick Cheney, Sean Hannity, Senator Mitch McConnell, Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin, David Horowitz, Mike Pence, Newt Gingrich, Phyllis Schlafly, Wayne Pierre, and many more. So, yes, Bernie Sanders will be with us the first hour Friday. We always do brunch with Bernie. We've been doing that for 3.5 years and have no plans of stopping. But other than that little island of sanity on Friday, we're going to have as many of these folks on as we can, and we'll see if we can get to the heart of some of these issues. I think it should be very interesting. It should make very entertaining radio. I'm paying for this trip out of my own pocket. I think that it's just, I think it's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. So that's tomorrow and the next day. The point that I wanted to make about what's going on with the trade deficit, and then we'll get to your phone calls here, is very simple and very straightforward. As a country, we should have a national industrial policy. As a country, we should have a national trade policy. And that trade policy should, at its core, at the very least, say that, by and large, we want to make sure that if we are buying, say, $1 trillion worth of stuff from the rest of the world, that we are selling $1 trillion worth of stuff to the rest of the world. Because otherwise, what happens is we end up a banana republic. I mean, one of the ways that so many third world countries got colonized for all practical purposes was economically. It wasn't that an army marched in. It was that a bunch of businessmen marched in and said, okay, we'll buy that business, we'll buy that business, we'll buy that business. This is what we did with Iraq. When Paul Bremer rewrote the Constitution in Iraq, he said any company can come in and buy anything they want. It's all for sale. The country's for sale. Didn't work very well for Iraq. It's not going to work very well for us. It's not working well for us right now. It would be a good idea if most of the businesses in America were actually owned by Americans. Not out of some kind of xenophobia, not out of some kind of, you know, conservative America first or whatever, but for the simple economic reason that the business is in companies are in business to do one thing, and that is to make a profit. And what they do with that profit is they typically, you know, spend it on, well, they distribute it as dividends, or they spend it on growth in other areas. And if they are making their profits someplace else and they're bringing their profits home, I mean, this is how the British Empire maintained itself. They made all their profits in India, and they brought all the profits to England. So England had a good standard of living, and India was poor. Well, now the British are buying America. And again, you know, the standard of living in the rest of the world is increasing. The standard of living of America is dropping. People wonder why. It's because of these insane trade policies promoted by these insane ideas that GATT and NAFTA and WTO and the whole world is flat bunch have been promoting. So we're at a position right now, and you can see this. There's a great website for all this stuff called economyandcrisis.org. Since 1978, basically since Reagan came into office, 13,948 American companies have been bought by foreign companies or foreign governments, totaling $1,750,846,770,202 worth of business. Now, that's just the equity, the value of those companies. 97% of the sound recording industries in this country are foreign-owned. 79% of the commodity contracts dealing in this country is foreign-owned. 75% of our motion picture and sound recording industries are foreign-owned. 65% of our metal ore mining is foreign-owned. 64% of our motion picture and video industries. 64% of our wineries. Our database directory and other publishers, 63%. Our book publishers, 63%. The list goes on and on. And what that means is that in all those areas, when people are doing business in America, they're taking their profits to China, they're taking their profits to Japan, they're taking their profits to Germany, they're taking their profits to England, and we're not seeing the profits, and thus America is not being reinvested in. And so our roads start to decay, and our infrastructure starts to crumble, and our schools don't do well, and our tax base disintegrates, and it's harder and harder to start a new business in America. This is what a trade deficit means. A trade deficit is a disaster for a country. And we have been running one for about 20 years now. And it's gotten huge. It was a record last year, over $700 billion. And it's the result of these insane trade policies. This is not the budget deficit that Bush is bragging about. That's another deficit. I mean, we have dual deficit. And then we have, you know, the savings deficit of Americans. That's for another show altogether. Brian in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening on WPTT. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Hey, great show. And I've listened to you for quite a while, and I've learned a bunch from you. But I'm curious about something, and I'm not presenting it as an argument. But when the years after World War II, when the United States, like after the Marshall Plan, like for instance, I can think of GM, and they had an Opel division in Germany. Is that correct?
No, Opel was actually a European-owned company. GM bought them like 15 or 20 years ago, maybe even less than that.
But what I'm curious about, I can't think of a specific example. But did the United States companies that set up shop or some overseas operations, did they bring their profit back home?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's what was happening. In fact, it's the reverse. I mean, what used to happen back in the 30s, well, not so much the 30s, but in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, was you had other companies, or countries rather, complaining about U.S. economic imperialism, saying, hey, you know, American businesses are coming into our country, they're buying up our industries, they are making a profit, and they're taking that profit back to the United States. And it was true. We were acting like economic imperialists. It wasn't right then for us to do that. It's not right now for us to be the victims of it. In both cases, we should have had a rational policy. In both cases, by the way, the winners, while the losers back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and back in the 19th century as well, while the losers back then were third world countries and the winner were, you know, seemingly was America, the big winner really were the multinational corporations. And today, now, as America is being sold off, we're the losers, we the citizens of the United States, we the nation of the United States of America. But once again, the winners, there are clear winners in this, the winners are the multinational corporations. So either way you slice it, the winners are the multinational corporations. And that's why I say we need a government policy that that clarifies this stuff, that says, no, that's not how we're going to do it. Len in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Len, what's on your mind?
Hi, you know, everything you're talking about is true, but it feels like it's much more complex than the way you're, you know, painting it.
Well, there's a lot more dimensions to it, but I think it's so important that people just begin to understand the pieces. I mean, the trade deficit is just one piece of it.
Yeah.
And
can I follow a couple of thoughts down the road? The China drop yesterday was like 10% of their market. But for us, it was only about 1% of our market value.
No, it was 9% of theirs, and it was 3.3% of ours.
3% of ours?
Yeah, 3.3%.
Or just the Dow?
The Dow 30 industrials. Just, you know, the top 30 stocks, the top 30 industrial stocks on the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
But anyway, you know, all these drops, you know, don't mean that much compared to, I mean, globalization, you know, and productivity combined is holding down wages. To such an extent, you're there, right?
Yes.
You know, to such an extent that's been the major problem that we had, that there is absolutely
that's the major problem for the middle class.
That's right. There's no room whatsoever for wages going up. But the slow bleed from all the borrowing, you know, is really, and don't you love the term slow bleed in its appropriate form?
Yeah.
The slow bleed from all the borrowing isn't much of anything compared to the shock that's going to come with the increase in the Medicare and the Social Security bills down the road.
Well, yes and no, and that's a whole other thing, Len. And you know, I appreciate your bringing it up, and I can't do it justice in the 30 seconds we've got left. But no, I'm not.
Let me just point the two solutions. Can I just
Sure.
The two solutions really are to increase the Social Security base. And to increase taxes to the point where we're actually not allowing anybody to slip away from a tax system.
Yeah, the simple solution for Social Security and Medicare is to do away with the cap. I mean, right now, the first $94,000 of income is taxed for Social Security. And after that, if you make $1 million or if you make $1 billion, you don't pay any tax on it.
You're right.
And
but we
I think that billionaires.
We also have to collect it from the 15 million people who aren't, or 20 million people who aren't paying it at all because they're being hired cheaply as illegals.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a whole other issue, too. and some people would say, well, yeah, those people are paying in and they're not getting anything out. That's, boy, we went down two completely different roads there. I want to get back to the trade deficit, and we'll deal with immigration on another day. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
What's happening? We're selling out to foreigners. They're taking over everything. Wealth-producing companies, the best the world has known. We've sold more than 8,000 of them in 10 years alone. IBM PCs sold out to the Red Chinese. Westinghouse Nuclear belongs to the Japanese. The French have taken away Lucent and RCA. And Chrysler is Germany.
And then to make it even stranger, the U.S. Congress appropriated your and my tax dollars to give a loan to Westinghouse, which is now a Japanese company, to build a nuclear reactor in India so that they could have cheap electricity to compete with us. Now, tell me that we have some kind of a policy in this country that makes sense. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman back with you. 866-303-2270, our number. Mara Lee and TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Mara Lee in San Diego, California. Hey, Mara Lee.
Hi there, Tom.
And thanks for listening on KLSD, by the way.
Oh, yeah. So I the fellow you had on from the Cato Institute. Yes, he was saying that well, just go buy American, you know, and you should try that. I had to buy some sheets last night. I went to Target, and my choices were China, Pakistan, and Bahrain.
Yeah. No, I you know, and this is the real problem, Early. I remember when Louise and I were living in Vermont, and I wanted to buy some new pillows. And the only place I could find them, I mean, I lived in Montpelier, this little town. It was the state capital, but it's 9,000 people. But there were a lot of locally owned businesses. But nobody sold pillows anymore. The only place I could find pillows was Walmart. And I had to go, you know, 30, 40 miles away to Walmart to get them. And that's kind of grim. There are people who call into the program who say, oh, you know, Walmart, bad business practices, we need to boycott them. My take on all this, and this gets back exactly to what you're talking about too, Mara Lee, is that we don't have the choices of buying American, mm-hmm. is that it's not evil companies doing, you know, it's not evil Walmart, it's not evil, you know, whatever company it was where you couldn't find an American-made sheets. It is the stupidity of our industrial processes. Now, you could argue that stupidity is intentional, and it is because our legislators are bought and sold by some of these evil corporations, and I would not dispute that. But nonetheless, it's happening because we, the people, are allowing it to happen, and we need to wake up and say, wait a minute, it's not a matter of boycotting. People say, oh, well, just buy American. Well, you know, vote with your dollars. Well, that sounds nice. It's a great slogan. The problem is, if you vote with your dollars, A, the richest people have the most votes, and that's not democracy, and B, there's a lot of people who have no choices. I mean, when I was in Montpelier, I had no choice but to buy those pillows there, or I could buy them online, I suppose. And B, there's a lot of poor people for whom, you know, they can't afford to shop any place other than Walmart, for example. And so I think that we need to be addressing this at the level of national policy rather than blaming the consumers for it. It makes sense?
Yeah. You know, and it used to be that you could, you would find that the American product was a lot better made.
Oh, yeah. It used to be great stuff. And Sam Walton built Walmart on the whole thing of, you know, made in the USA. And I'm telling you, he's rolling over in his grave. Thank you, Mara Lee, for the call. And I appreciate it. Jack in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
I feel like I should be paying somebody tuition listening to this.
Hopefully you're also being entertained. In any case.
So I guess I'll give the money to your sponsors instead.
That's a fine plan.
Yeah, but anyway, I was listening to an interview with Senator Edwards, and I heard him say when he was asked, are you for terrorists? He said, protectionism doesn't work, and that's been proven. And I was just wondering, what was the proof that it didn't work?
There is no proof that it doesn't work. And in fact, there is 200 years of proof that protectionism does work. There's a reason why if we manufacture a car in the United States and want to import it into China, they charge us a 20% tariff. And, you know, they're protecting their markets. There's a reason why Japan protects their markets. There's a reason why Korea protects their markets. There's a reason why virtually every country in the world protects their markets except us and a few other countries that have drunk the right-wing Kool-Aid. And the reason why Edwards is saying that he's against protectionism is because right now in the United States, so many people have read Tom Friedman. So many people have drank that Kool-Aid. And the multinational corporations have so much power and so much control over the mainstream media that to come out in favor of protectionism in the United States is political suicide, and John Edwards isn't willing to commit political suicide. And I understand that. I honor that. You know, I disagree with him on the position, but I'm not going to attack him for it, because you will not find any politicians who are willing to take that position. There's a few. I mean, Edwards will say our trade policies are wrong and then we need to fix them. You know, probably the most outspoken is Bernie Sanders, who says, you know, let's just take them down. You know, let's not, you know, all this nonsense about let's fix them with, you know, workplace protections and environmental. No, let's just do away with them. We don't need them. We need to have a national industrial policy. I think that's more rational. But frankly, I think that if we had somebody who was progressive like Edwards as president, and we had a good, strong progressive majority in the House and Senate, which is only going to happen if we get active, then we could be taking on some of these positions and we could be doing it well. Thanks a lot for the call, Jack. Doug in the Bronx. Hey, yeah. Doug, what's up?
Yeah, hello. Well, this is a complicated subject, and I'm just going to stick to the things I know the most, and it's history, and I know you're a historian. That's why I'm shocked about some of the things you're saying. I'm a Democrat, and so I'm not saying this negatively, as far as I can tell, but the Democrat Party has always been the anti-tariff party compared to the Republican Party.
First of all, it's the Democratic Party. There's no such thing as a Democrat Party.
I said the Democrat Party. I never say the Democrat Party.
Okay, I misheard you. God bless you,
Doug. I never say the Democrat Party.
You know, with regard to Smoot, I do too. With regard to Smoot Hawley, you're absolutely right. Smoot Hawley.
That's right. I didn't even say Smoot Hawley yet.
You know, that was
right.
A Republican bill.
What?
Okay, but you're right that in many cases throughout history, Democrats have opposed tariffs. So have
Franklin
Republicans.
Franklin Roosevelt. Look, the reason why Edwards, I think the bigger reason why Edwards and Al Gore and Clinton and going all the way back probably to Grover Cleveland, I'm not sure about Wilson, but the policies of beginning with Franklin Roosevelt were for lowering tariffs. He, in 1934, you know this, he had the reciprocal trade agreements.
And the reciprocal is the magic word, Doug, because all of those Democrats wanted lower tariffs by other countries so that we could sell our exported goods.
That's why Edwards.
And what we have now is we have done away with our tariffs, and we don't give a damn about anybody else's. Doug, I'm sorry, we'll have to carry on the conversation at another time, but Doug, you make a good point, and it's, as you say, it is a complex issue, but we do need to have a rational policy in this country. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to continue our conversation about the economy. I really want to get into this whole thing about consumer debt. There's really strange stuff going on with the U.S. mortgage crisis and the federal government cutting back on subprime loans, which seems like just one of those really esoteric things, but I'm telling you, it is going to whack the middle class, particularly that part of the middle class that's been whacked by Reaganomics really hard. And we will get back to that in just a few moments. But first, right now, we have with us
Chuckin', got my chips still skin.
It's Al Franken. Hey, Al.
Hey, it's good to hear the dead again. I haven't been hearing him since I left the show. Thank you, by the way, for picking up the banner.
You're welcome.
Did I pass the banner to you? Is that what I did?
I think you did, and thank you for passing it. I am honored to be sitting here in this seat. And
well, I'm honored to have you sitting there in the seat. Yeah.
Thank you. I heard that you're well into your fundraising activities, that you're setting up a kissing booth with Meg Ryan at the Minnesota State Fair.
Well, this way is to an go. Idea. This is an idea I've had for a while. I thought, you know, Meg did this movie, When a Man Loves a Woman, about 10 years ago, or maybe more now. Yeah, I guess more, that I co-wrote. And she in it played an alcoholic and Andy Garcia, her husband. And so Meg and I have been friends ever since, and I thought that what better way to use Meg than as in a kissing booth at the state fair.
Has she signed off on this?
But then we were going to actually have to consult, like, some medical experts to see if there would be a danger to her in terms of, you know, herpes can ruin a career, especially for a beautiful woman.
You get some saran wrap in front of her or something, you know.
Then I don't think you get the $5 for the kiss. So yeah, we got to figure this out.
That's true. Yeah. So how's it going though? I mean, seriously, you're running now for the Senate in Minnesota. I think you'll make a great senator. And
Thank you.
First of all, you count on me for, you know, whatever campaign donation I could afford. I'm going to support you, and I want to support
well,
you.
Well, with the big bucks,
well.
I know you're getting from Air America.
Yeah,
so
well,
I'm sure you'll max
there.
Out.
But the point is, I'm wondering A, how it's going, and B, how our listeners who, you know, remember you well can help out.
Well, thanks for asking. First of all, it's going great. We, you know, I'm really jazzed. Of course, it's only day 15 out of 640. But we've been, you know, the first thing we did was events in the metro area in Twin Cities. But then we went up to, like, Nash Walk, which is on the Iron Range, and 200 people showed up at a Union Hall in a town where there's 950 people.
I was gonna say, that's pretty good for Nash Walk.
Yeah, and then we went to Duluth, and we had 800 people show up at the Wellstone Hall at the Labor Temple there. The place fits about 450 people. Then we went down to Rochester, and we had to change the venues because so many people showed up. And we have all kinds of people volunteering, and then we were actually down in Mankato, and, you know, I now have a tracker. Remember Makaka? The guy who tracked Webb, Dave sent a tracker, right? But we like the tracker. He's a nice guy. And for the Republican, you know, the Republican, you know, communications director is down at this big event in Manchester, Mankato, and he says to one of my campaign guys, he goes, "Man, this is a great event."
Uh-huh.
So we've had, that's what it's been like. And then we were just,
see, your tracker's becoming a fan.
Yeah, it's weird, you know, it's like this odd kind of thing that happens, this dynamic, you know.
Is it the Stockholm Syndrome, Al?
Well, I don't think he'll go back and lie viciously about me. And then, you know, we were up this past weekend during a blizzard in up in Fergus Falls and Detroit Lakes and a town called Dilworth, and Dilworth, it was overflowing, and it's really been exciting. And, you know, if people want to help me, they can, in one way or another, they can go to the website, which is www.alfranken.com, and I would encourage people also to look at our web video, webcast, I guess that's what you call it, that kicked off the campaign, and also some photos of some of these events we've been doing. And this is our, you know, mini website. Our big website will launch in about a month, I guess, or a few weeks. And so, yeah, and now I'm doing, you know, what's called call time, because this guy, the guy I'm running against, Coleman, you know, he's against Medicare negotiating for prescription drugs, right? With the pharmaceutical companies. Well, guess what? Hundreds of thousands from pharmaceutical companies,
in
donations to him. So he's getting money from big, you know, big oil, big utilities, big insurance, which is also part of this Medicare Part D thing. Mm-hmm. And big pharmaceuticals. And I, you know, I'm getting the literal order donations, but those count more as far as I'm concerned. And as someone who hasn't been a politician all his life. This, I come to this, you know, with no obligations to anybody, but except for the small donations that I get. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious. We have about 3 minutes here in the segment. I'm curious what you think are the real issues that are facing Minnesotans in particular, obviously, but also the nation. As a senator, you reflect the nation as well as the state.
Yeah, I mean, it's a federal office, so you're looking at, and also it's the same stuff. It is healthcare. You know, we in this country pay 34% of our healthcare dollar goes to administrative fees. No other country does that. We have more Americans uninsured, and yet the insurance companies are increasing their employment by a tremendous amount. We spend 16% of our GDP on healthcare. No other country spends more than 11%, but we're 37th, according to the World Health Organization, in healthcare. We're between Costa Rica and Slovenia. You know, access to education, you know, one of the things Democrats did right away was cut the interest rates on student loans. You know, Republicans said, oh, well, that was an easy vote. And the answer to that was, yeah, why didn't you do it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we raised the minimum wage. Well, that was an easy vote. Yeah, why didn't you do it?
Well, now they're trying to stick these riders on it, yeah.
Well, I know. Now they're in the Senate, of course, they're trying to do that. And, our energy policy is a huge issue regarding a whole bunch of things. Obviously, national security, obviously balance of payments, but creating jobs. There are great jobs to be created. We can do manufacturing jobs. We have a Ford plant closing in St. Paul. There's no reason that plant now can't make windmills and put them in, southwestern Minnesota, which is incredibly windy.
or why not have a national industrial policy of some kind that would encourage Ford to be manufacturing Fords there again?
Well, part of the reason Ford is shipping its jobs to Canada and stuff is that Canada has universal health care.
Right.
So it's national health care. So it costs nothing in health care per car to make it in Windsor, but it costs $1,500 a car to make it in Minneapolis or in St. Paul or in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something. What's very interesting is you see the Business Roundtable, the AARP, and SEIU getting together and saying, we got to go to universal health care and we got to do it quick.
Yeah.
We got to do it soon. And this is, you know, business, labor, old people getting together and saying, hey, this is ridiculous. And there's a reason that business needs that. I think the critical mass is there. Because I think business knows that it's paying a big, big price for the inefficiency that we have in the way we do healthcare.
Yeah, all of business except for the healthcare industry itself, which has a lot of power and a lot of influence in Washington.
Yes, that's your big money. And again, my opponent has been getting, just had a big fundraiser for insurance companies.
Oh, really?
In Washington, you know, one of these things where lobbyists come and drop off $10,000 checks and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I need the help of, I hope people remember me from Air America. I was there for 3 years.
There you go. We all remember you well.
So it's AlFranken.com.
Yep, AlFranken.com is the website. Al, thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Tom, thank you. I hope to be on a lot, okay?
I hope you are, too. Anytime.
Thanks.
You're always welcome here.
Okay,
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. AlFranken.com. Check it out. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I do believe there's a dream for everyone. There's room enough here for science to live, and there's room enough.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. A place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, you know, actually, we fiendishly plot for national health care and clean elections. How about clean elections? We'd really settle for that because then we'd usually win. Isn't it amazing how in New Mexico, in the state of New Mexico, when they went to paper ballots instead of paperless voting machines, all of a sudden, in Native American communities and Hispanic communities, all of a sudden, the Republicans started losing when before on the electronic machines they'd been winning. I was just, it's like night and day. Gee, what an amazing thing. And you know, this was brought about because they noticed this oddity that those people who voted by on paper because they did absentee ballots or the machines weren't working seemed to vote for Democrats. But whenever they voted on the machines, it always seemed to record it for the Republicans. New stuff. Anyhow, I digress. Home mortgages. This is just since Bush became president. Our debt, home mortgage debt, has gone from $1.8 trillion to $8.2 trillion. Consumer debt has gone from $2.7 trillion to $11 trillion. You get it? We're living on our credit cards, and we're using our houses as ATM machines. Our household debt, since Bush became president, has nearly quadrupled. At the same time, the companies that are spinning off profits that could be taxed are increasingly moving offshore, like Halliburton's KBR division reincorporated in the Cayman Islands so that they don't have to pay federal taxes. Or they're simply foreign-based companies, and they move the money around in ways that they don't pay taxes at all. They've become essentially our bankers. Now, you add that to the fact that now this article, this in today's Wall Street Journal, I read this thing, and it. I'm telling you, you read this and your blood runs cold when you realize what these people are talking about. There's three stories on page A2, on the second page of the Wall Street Journal. You should read all three of them. Number one, durable goods orders plunged 7.8% in January. In other words, the economy's going soft. Number three, at the bottom of the page, states' pension shortfalls widen amid an increase in tax receipts. Okay. State pensions, on average, were funded at slightly more than 100% obligations. In other words, you pay in for your pension, but that money then gets invested by the states. And some of those states are not doing so well with their investments. For example, West Virginia has 50% of all the money that's been paid. It's lost. Why? Because they invested it in the stock market. Now, on the other hand, Florida, they've got 107% of their pension funds. In other words, they made money on their investments. Maybe because Jeb Bush was in charge and he knew that the war was coming and he said, hey, put the state pension money in Halliburton stock. I mean, I don't know. I'm just guessing. But Illinois, Connecticut, Oklahoma, all of them have gaps in the 40% range. Unfunded obligations. And this is what Bush wants you and I to do with our Social Security money. Let's just, you know, privately invest it. When these professional investors are losing money with people's pension money. But the big one, the big killer was the second one, the one right in the middle of the page. Freddie won't buy some subprime loans. And you go, what the heck is that? Freddie Mac, it was a corporation that was originally started as a federally chartered corporation. It's now spun off private. It's the biggest provider of funding for U.S. home mortgages. A subprime mortgage means a mortgage for somebody who doesn't have very good credit. And for the last 10, 15 years or so, Freddie Mac has been underwriting subprime mortgages. So it's been possible for people in the middle and on the lower end of the middle class and the working poor to get a loan to buy a house. Well, guess what? The piper needs to be paid. There is so much debt now, and so many of these things are defaulting. These subprime mortgages, which were only 5% of the market in 2001 when Bush came into office, now are 20% of the total mortgage market, and they're starting to go into default. This is from the Wall Street Journal. 2.2 million subprime loans, or about 15%, originated between 1998 and the third quarter of last year, are going to end in foreclosure. And so what's Freddie Mac doing? They're saying we're not going to guarantee these loans anymore. What this is going to mean, and, you know, it's going to take some time. It's going to take a few months. It might take a year. But what it's going to mean is that a massive number of Americans who could have gotten a mortgage a month ago will not be able to get a mortgage next month and will not be able to buy a house. If they can't buy the house, they can't use the house as the ATM machine by taking out, you know, increasingly more and more and more, you know, second mortgages and refis and all that kind of thing. And if they can't do that, they can't live on debt. And if they can't live on debt, then they stop buying. And if they stop buying, then the economy goes in the tank. And then you have what Alan Greenspan was predicting yesterday, which is a recession. And it all goes back to debt. It all goes back to the failure of us, of this country, to have a national industrial policy. It all goes back to Reaganomics. It all goes back to the insanity. I'm telling you, that crazy old coot with the big ears and the charts and graphs was right in that presidential debate. Ross Perot was right. And that giant sucking sound of these trade policies and doing away with tariffs here in the United States. Oh, let's just do away. We don't care if anybody else has tariffs. We'll just do away with ours. Yeah, it helps the multinational corporations. It is screwing us. And then on top of that, this thing about unionization. I'll tell you that, and then we'll take your calls. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Well, my face may not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's actually two quick stories I want to share with you. The first, this is what it's all about. I'm telling you, this is what it's all about. The people say, well, you know, we don't have an industrial policy, or we're doing the Tom, you know, the billionaire Tom Friedman thing, or we're doing, you know, whatever, and it's helping out the multinational corporations. But isn't that okay? No, it's about screwing the middle class. And the reason that the conservatives want to screw the middle class, the reason why they don't want there to be a strong middle class, is that when the middle class was at its peak in the United States, in the 1770s, we had this conversation, I think on Monday, well, no, it might have been last week, we had this conversation about Jefferson. I mean, those guys were not incredibly wealthy. They were the upper middle class of their day. The wealthy went back to England during the Revolutionary War. And so in the 1770s, the middle class rose up and said, no, we're not going to take this. And they overthrew the king. And in the 1970s, the second time we had a strong middle class in the United States, as a result of Franklin Roosevelt's policies, as a consequence of that, in the 1970s, the middle class stood up and said, no, we're not going to take this anymore either. You know, we're not going to go fight your war. And women and minorities and gays and all right across the whole spectrum of society, people who had been left out were saying, we want part of it. And so the conservative thinkers, the Leo Strausses of the world, the Russell Kirks of the world said, well, you know, we got to do something about this middle class thing. And they got Ronald Reagan elected. And he started taking apart the middle class. And what's the core of building a middle class? Unionization. So here's the story. This is the Associated Press. President Bush and his Senate allies will kill a 9/11 anti-terror bill if Congress sends it to the White House with a provision to let airport screeners unionize, said the White House and 36 Republicans yesterday. Senate Republicans swiftly backed up the threat with a pledge by more than enough senators to block any veto override attempt. It's all about destroying the middle class. That's the Republican agenda, and has been, well, it has been for a long, long time. But it has been, I mean, they've actually been accomplishing it aggressively since the 1980s. And on a lighter note, those of you who listen to the program regularly or have for years and years, or the 4 years that we've been on the air starting tomorrow, next month, March, by the way, our fourth anniversary, know that I've always been partial. I'm not saying that I subscribe to this, but I have a friend in New York who has a friend who I've met many times who is rather eccentric and has this theory, and this guy's dead serious, absolutely believes this, that pigeons are actually robots from, like, the planet Xena or something, that the mothership comes along, you know, once a year and drops them off, and they're spying on us. And they're actually little robots. And the reason that you know that they're robots and that they're spying on us is, first of all, whenever there's a meeting of world leaders, what do you have? Millions of pigeons. Now, we've all seen the pictures, right? You know, they walk out of the meeting at the Kremlin, or they walk out of the meeting in Switzerland, or they walk out of the meeting in Rome, and what happens? The pigeons go flying. Number one, they're spying on us. And number two, you never see a dead pigeon, you never see a baby pigeon. So they've got to be robots. Well, here comes this story now from the Xinhua News Service. Chinese scientists said that they have succeeded in an experiment to remotely control the flight of a pigeon with electronic technology. Scientists with the Robot Engineering Technology Research Center of East China's Shandong University of Science and Technology say they implanted microelectrodes in the brain of a pigeon so they can command it to fly left or right or up or down. So, I'll bet my friend's friend in New York would say, well, see, maybe they're... Either this is the part of the Chinese plane, you know, doing this on behalf of the people from the planet Xeno or whatever it is, or maybe the pigeons in the United States are Chinese robots. Who knows? I don't know. So I'll just toss that out for you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gary in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Tom. Earlier when you were talking about... tariffs. You implied that the United States is full of brain dead trade negotiators.
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah. Well, everybody knows that the United States has got the greatest, most savvy trade negotiators there are, able to give away the economic store without a single brain cell firing. I think you're right.
Gary.
Those tariffs, you know, they provided the protections. But what I wanted to say about I wonder where the inflation is.
Yeah.
During and after World War II, there was a round of inflation.
Right.
During and after the Korean police action, there was a round of inflation.
And after Vietnam.
And during and after the Vietnam police action, there was a round
right.
of inflation. But when I look at the current figures, you look at the inflation rates, it's relatively low. You look at the unemployment rates, it's relatively low. What has happened to that round of inflation?
Okay, two things. First of all, the unemployment rate is phony. It's phony baloney. If you were to calculate unemployment in the United States the same way they do in France, we'd have about a 10% unemployment rate. And that doesn't count underemployment, which would be even larger. So number one, we do have an unemployment problem. Number two, with regard to inflation, the reason why we're not seeing so much inflation, A, in part, they're jiggering the numbers again. You know, they don't count, for example, the cost of gasoline into the inflation rate. Gee, what do we all buy? Gasoline. They don't count the cost of medical services into the inflation rate, the official inflation rate. Gee, what do we all buy? Medical services. So they say, oh, look at that, medical services are going up at twice the inflation rate. Well, shouldn't we consider that part of the inflation rate? Oh no, we can't do that. So number one, the numbers are all phony. Number two, we are beginning to see it. And the reason why you have inflation after wars like this is because these were all wars that were fought with borrowed money. And since the government controls the value of money, what they do is they borrow money at a certain value, and then when it comes time to pay it back, they decrease the value of it so they can pay it off with cheaper money. And this is a small version of what the Germans did after World War One. After World War One, and Gary, I'm going to have to drop your call. I'm sorry here because your phone is just bleeding through so loud. But you made your point really well, and I appreciate the call. After World War One, at the Treaty of Versailles, the nations that felt that they were the victims of German aggression or the victims of Germany, let's say, as a consequence of World War One, got together at the Treaty of Versailles and put some very, very severe punishments on Germany. They basically said, okay, you've got to pay us back to rebuild the damage that you did to our countries. And it was denominated in Deutschmarks. I don't remember the amount. Let's say it was $100 billion just for the heck of it. And so they said to Germany, okay, you've got to pay back $100 billion, and $50 billion of it goes to England, and $30 billion of it goes to France, and $20 billion of it goes to Belgium or whatever, okay? And so Germany, the Weimar Republic, Germany says, okay, fine, we owe you $100 billion. We don't have it. We can't raise taxes that much. And, you know, with the hindsight of history, the the hit was punitive. I mean, it was really harsh. And so what the German government did was they said, okay, you denominated it in Deutschmarks. We owe you 100 billion Deutschmarks. Right now, with the average person making a salary of 1,000 Deutschmarks a year, that's a lot of taxes and a lot of people. But we can change that. And so they just ran the printing presses like crazy to the point where it cost literally, no joke, literally a million Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread. So when you reach the point where a million Deutschmarks will buy a loaf of bread, then 100 billion Deutschmarks is like, what, a day's salary, 2 days' salary? And so the Germans were able to pay off their war debts with cheap dollars. Well, we're doing the same. This is the game we've been playing. This is why what you can buy today in terms of gold or bread or any other real commodity, what you can buy today with $1, you could have bought in 1915 for about 10 cents, or some would say as little as 5 or 6 cents. And that steady erosion of the value of the dollar is called inflation. And so after we do a whole huge series of borrowing, then the government runs the printing presses like crazy to inflate the currency so that they can pay it off and what that does is it causes everybody's income to go up, not in real dollars, in inflated dollars, and thus their taxes go up because we have a progressive tax system, so they kick them into higher tax brackets, and thus generating more revenue for the government and thus giving them the ability to pay off the debts at lower cost. And now this last March, and this was a very alarming thing, a year ago this month, or no, it was in October, the Bush administration stopped publishing M3, which is the number that the Treasury Department publishes that tells you how fast they're inflating the currency, how fast they're running the printing presses relative to how much money is out there. And that's something that's got a lot of the world spooked. And this is why I've been saying on this program for a couple of years now, look out, it's coming. Not, you know, some kind of chicken little look out, it's going to be a 1929-style disaster. I hope we don't go that far. I really hope and pray we don't. It's going to cause so much pain. But at the very least, what you're going to see, what we're seeing right now, is the steady erosion of the value of the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies around the world, where they actually have rational trade policies and rational domestic fiscal policies, and they're not being run by a bunch of crazed Republicans who are borrowing trillions and trillions of dollars from the rest of the world. Number one, you're going to see inflation and the decrease in the value of the dollar. And number two, you're going to see an increase in the value of real commodities, you know, gold, oil, things like that. And just my opinion. I'm not an economist. I might be wrong. I just think I'm looking at this with some common sense. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll get back to your phone calls right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. Be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
There's the dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Indeed, welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Always look at the sunny side. There really generally is a sunny side. I think the sunny side of all of this is, A, we can learn from the lessons of history. B, we can tell other people we can still talk in this country, at least to some extent. And C, if enough of us get active, we can do something about it. And I'm actually seeing that trend right now in national politics, and it's very, very gratifying to me. I'm very enthusiastic about it. Robert Montana. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Keeping with the idea of keeping it simple and that the problems are relatively easy to fix, I look at the situation in the world. Our social, economic, political, environmental, and health problems all boil down to our lifestyle as Americans. We live in a very consumeristic culture, I don't think I have to tell you. There are some small solutions that we can do to fix these problems, And I think it just comes down to deciding between needs and wants. An example would be our food production. If people took more responsibility in producing their own foods, we alleviate environmental problems. We use less petrochemicals by the agribusinesses, herbicides, pesticides.
We did this in World War II. People had victory gardens. I mean, you were encouraged to turn your lawn into a garden, and that is a patriotic thing. And I remember when Louise and I moved to Atlanta in 1983, we bought a house in the way northern suburbs, a little town called Roswell, which is actually now just, you know, Atlanta has bled into it. It's all one town. And it was, you know, kind of one of these not – it wasn't McMansions, but it was, you know, a nice neighborhood. And there was a neighborhood association, and one of the rules was that you can't grow vegetables in your lawn. You can't have a garden.
Right.
And it's like, wait a minute, you can only have grass? Well, grass comes out of people trying to emulate people in the 18th century trying to emulate the British lords who grew grass around their manor houses and their castles as a way of proving that they were so wealthy that they didn't have to grow food, that they had serfs that would do the food for them. It was a status symbol. We don't need status symbols anymore. I agree with you. We need a certain level of self-sufficiency. I remember when we lived in a small town in Germany, most people's front yards, I'd say half the people in town, their front yard was a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing when I worked in Russia. Same thing there. And that's something that we should be doing here. I agree.
We also reduce the consumption of oil by having our food shipped to us. There are a lot of organizations in
urban areas. And it's healthier food.
Right. There's organizations in urban areas that are using vacant land to produce community agriculture.
Yeah, we've had, in fact, there's a big group in Los Angeles doing that. We had them on as guests here a while ago. Now, there's so much that we can do, Robert, and thank you for calling and pointing it out. In my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, there's a whole chapter about the truth and the lie of consumerism. And I forget the title of the chapter. It's, in any case, the point is that there is a certain truth, and that is that if you're cold and naked and outdoors and alone at night, you are going to be unhappy. And if somebody says, oh, here's some clothes, and come on into the house, and you can sit in front of the fire, and here's a bowl of warm soup, and there's a bed you can sleep in, you're going to go from unhappy to happy real quickly. And we all agree on that. So there is a certain level. Abraham Maslow said this in his hierarchy of needs, you know, at the bottom two levels, safety and security. There is a certain level where stuff will make us happy. But once you get above that level, it really doesn't. But so the truth is that a certain amount of stuff will make you happy, but the lie, and it's the lie of our society, and this goes to this story that's been in the press the last couple of days about narcissism among college students, and I think it's the consequence of overexposure to advertising, because the major message of all advertising is, you are the most important person in the world. I mean, that's the fundamental message of advertising. The truth is, a small amount of stuff will make you happy. The lie is, well, if that amount of stuff will make you happy, then 10 times as much stuff will make you 10 times as happy. 100 times will make you 100 times as happy. 1,000 times will make you 1,000 times. 1,000,000 times will make you 1,000,000. And Bill Gates lives in a state of perpetual bliss. And it's just not true. And we need to be not only ourselves waking up for it, but perhaps even more importantly, we need to be helping our children wake up from that and helping, you know, the current and the next generation wake up from it. Lester in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Lester, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I was just calling because I'd like to congratulate you on your opinions on Jefferson, and I appreciate that. I'm an African-American, and I also think Jefferson is one of our best presidents. I also want to congratulate you on your opinions about the labor movement. I think labor does need to be addressed, and I do think these neocons are actually protecting the rich and not taking care of the regular people.
Yeah, in fact, they're you know, among themselves and in their own publications, they're pretty upfront about it. That's the spooky thing, Lester. I mean, they don't even pretend.
Oh, well, it's really getting pretty audacious in their power to grab and steal. And I think that we really need to work on the unions. And the most important thing I think we need to is protect our tariffs and protect our jobs so that we have manufacturing jobs, so we ain't worrying about the Chinese market collapsing. I think we need to actually start reproducing shirts, clothing, and that the tariffs have to come back in place to keep a check and balancing so that we still have jobs and a middle class. And we
at least within a reasonable range. Yeah, I agree. And you had a piece of legislation you wanted to promote.
Yes, I want to promote that legislation, the H.R. 42, the union bills.
Mm-hmm.
This is the
card check thing. I'm forgetting the name of it now. I don't have the piece of paper in front of me. But you remember the name, Lester, this piece of legislation?
It's the they the legislation for the union. I wish I did know the
it's,
name.
It's essentially the right to unionize legislation. I mean, it's like bringing this back. Yeah,
it's making it a lot easier so people can unionize so that they won't
right.
have to go through. So the big companies can't come in there and threaten the loss of their jobs and whatnot.
Right. So
the companies
people
can come in, and I that's why I keep up the good work, and I wish I could speak better and clearer.
No, that's fine. You did a great job, Lester, and I kept interrupting you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And the fact of the matter is that you know, we can, I mean, let your member of Congress know. The toll-free number, 800-862-5530, I believe, is a toll-free number for Congress. And, of course, the main number is 202-224-3121. And call and give me your zip code. That's Capitol Hill. Give me your zip code and say, I'd like to talk to my member of the House of Representatives and my two senators and tell them, we would like stronger protection for unionization in the United States. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Sr. is wont to call Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman with you. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you need to know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Everything you know about being homeless is wrong. By the way, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment is sponsored by TheLiberalStore.com. Include the THE in the URL. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's TheLiberalStore.com, www.TheLiberalStore.com. Renee Denfield is with us here in the studio. She's the author of a new book, All God's Children, Inside the Dark and Violent World of Street Families. Renee, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being here with us. You start out the story, you start out the book with the story of James Daniel Nelson in 1992. And why there? Why him?
Well, actually, there's two different answers there. In 1992, there was a group of street kids squatting near my home here in Portland, and they had formed a little tribe of sorts. I was intrigued with them because they had obviously kind of formed a little organization. And as it turned out, they committed a series of murders here in Portland.
Ouch.
Yes. And one of them went away, James Daniel Nelson, to prison for 11 years. He got out in 2003. Within 52 days, he had formed another little group of street youth, and they murdered again, this time a developmentally disabled African-American woman. And I became fascinated with the idea of these street kids and this culture they've formed, especially these little groups that they call their street families, which are in many ways more akin to gangs than actual families. These are little tribes of these street kids that you see downtown in the square and other places panhandling. They've actually formed an organized...
By kids, what age are you talking about?
Well, that's a good point, because actually most of them are not actual minors. The majority of these street youth who call themselves street kids are ages 18 on up to even their late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the youth you see down in the square, different places, panhandling, hanging out, are actually young adults who are living a homeless sort of lifestyle and part of this subculture, identifying as street kids. And what I found out is it's quite organized.
What? You said that you have some familiarity with this.
Yeah, I had a personal reason for wanting to investigate this subject as a reporter, and that is my own history. When I was 15, I lived on the streets myself here in Portland, Oregon. At that time, to put it nicely, the streets were very rough. The downtown core was characterized by a lot of poverty. We didn't have the gentrification that has happened now. To be homeless and young was often to mean you were going to be victimized by pimps and pedophiles. And there were virtually no services at that time for homeless youth. Many of us stayed in the bus station that was downtown all night just to avoid the streets. So I honestly went into this story wanting to find out about the lives of street youth now with a lot of assumptions. I assumed that most of the youth would be abused and neglected. I assumed that there would be a lack of programs to help them. And actually, honestly, I found the opposite was true in most cases. We have a lot more programs to help these youth now, but actually we seem to have more youth. And most of the ones I investigated actually came from perfectly adequate homes and were choosing to live on the streets.
We're talking with Renee Denfield. She's the author of All God's Children. She's also the author of two previous books, including the international bestseller, The New Victorians, and she's written for numerous publications, including the New York Times Magazine. This book, All God's Children, Inside the Dark and Violent World of Street Families. I worked in the slums of Bogota, in the La Paz slum, and in Colombia. And when we first started the project down there, this was 15 years ago or so, the goal was to work. There's a community of, some say 100,000, others say as much as a million, but there's a large community of street kids living down there that is so violent and so dangerous that relief agencies won't go in and work with them because they will kill you literally for your clothing, which they will then sell. And people bring babies down into that neighborhood thinking that the kids will raise them, and they use them for soup.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not seen up front personal in other cities, but I know that this exists in other cities, particularly in South America. I've seen it in Bogota. And we ended up not being able to actually work with that community because it was just too dangerous. And so we were working in one of the more conventional slums, the La Paz slum up on the side. And most of those people, or many of those people, were actually working. It was the working poor who were living in these little cardboard shacks and an open trench down the middle of the dirt road down the hillside that all the sewage ran down, and everybody was stealing electricity off a single piece of wire that ran along. So it's kind of one step up from that. I'm wondering, in the United States, do we have that same, you know, I haven't, oddly enough, worked in the cities of the United States with these same populations. And I'm wondering, is that same kind of hierarchy there, that there is that kind of psychopathological element of homeless?
Absolutely.
And then there's also just the real poor, you know, the poor who don't have any place else to go, and they're not violent or dangerous, and they do need services.
Exactly, and that's what really struck me, is we do have genuinely homeless youth in Portland. A lot of them come from backgrounds of abuse and neglect, disruption, foster care.
True all over America.
Oh, this is true, absolutely, all over America. And what was really striking to me was how often these youth were the least violent members of this community. In fact, they tend to get preyed upon by the street criminals who are out there and the other people who have kind of taken a more dominant role in the subculture. And I think anytime you have large groups of young people who are pretty much organizing their own society,
right,
you can imagine the outcomes with the levels of violence.
Yeah, he's a little Lord of the Flies societies,
exactly,
these subcultures. So would it be safe to say that large chunks of this population are simply mentally ill? I mean, I remember back in 1968, I hitchhiked across the United States. My wife in 68 or 69 hitchhiked across the United States, separate from each other, you know, but, I mean, we knew each other at the time, but it was between when we were dating. And both of us hitchhiked out to California, and no big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I hitchhiked out with a friend of mine who was a woman, and we were both like 17 or 18. And we, all across the United States, there was always somebody who'd feed you. I panhandled for a while in San Francisco on the streets as a kid. I mean, I was living in the heat, you know, in the summer of 68. And I never saw, I remember I even one night slept down on off Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley. You crashed where you could. There were open houses. It was a very different world then. I never saw that. And people suggest that Reagan, when he pulled funding for mental health services and basically threw open the doors of the mental hospitals in this country, and I realize there's a debate on this, you know, some people felt that people were being involuntarily confined, produced this epidemic of pathological or destructive or dangerous homelessness in the United States, whereas you could say his economic policies produced the poor homelessness, mm-hmm. that he produced the crazy homelessness.
Exactly. You have a lot of mentally ill people, and that's kind of the catch-22, is you have, say, a young person who's bipolar, undiagnosed, unmedicated, unhelped. That person needs serious intervention. They need some psychiatric care. They need something, and wraparound services to keep them safe. But that's not happening. You have a lot of mentally ill people who are out there, and you also have a real trickle down with the number of people that go into the criminal justice system. I found a lot of people who have pretty much graduated from prisons and who are now out on the streets being extremely violent and criminal because that's a lifestyle that they know.
So these populations are being commingled now because we're not differentiating them and we're not providing the specific and different services that each needs.
Exactly, and they have vastly different needs as far as how we're actually going to seriously get them off the streets.
How do we just have a few seconds left, how do we create a national discussion about this other than everybody reading your book, All God's Children, Inside the Dark and Violent World of Street Families? You're talking with Renee Denfeld.
I think we need more public discussion, and we need to have, frankly, more open dialogue about these youth and their very complex needs and what we can do to get them off the streets.
Should we roll back Reagan's rolling back of mental health services nationwide?
Well, actually, I really am a strong believer that we have a broken mental health system here in Oregon and elsewhere in the country, and we need to start identifying and helping people. And frankly, that's going to take money. That's going to take funds.
Yeah.
And we need outreach workers on the streets who are capable of doing that.
Right. And as soon as you say that's going to take money, then you've got the Republicans who are saying, no, wait a minute, tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, that's our priority. So anyway, we didn't want to turn this political. Renee Denfeld, her book is All God's Children, Inside the Dark and Violent World of Street Families. Is there a website, Renee?
Yeah, you can go to www.reneedenfeld.com.
R-E-N-E-D-E-N-F-E-L-D, Renee Denfeld. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 6 3 0 3 22 70. Back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Jim Nicholson, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. The Secretary of the Veterans Administration has some new information for us. I'll let Larry Scott tell us about this. Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org. One of the best websites out there for veterans and people concerned about the plight of veterans in the United States. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Arrogance, good to have you with us.
Arrogance and denial is what it was. As we all know, last night on ABC News, Bob Woodruff made a rather dramatic comeback after being severely injured in Iraq. He did a special called Iraq and Back, Bob Woodruff Reports. And part of that report was interviews with some little snippets of interviews with VA Secretary Jim Nicholson.
Yeah, and in fact, I have one I can play here if you'd like.
Go ahead. Let's do it.
Okay, here we go.
These are the big numbers, Bob. 200,000 have already gone into VA for medical care.
The official number is that there are only about 23,000 soldiers or Marines that have been injured in this war.
What you have are two sets of books. The Department of Defense saying that there's 23,000 wounded from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the Department of Veterans Affairs is actually treating 205,000 veterans from these two wars.
According to this internal VA report, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are being diagnosed with a wide variety of ailments, many for multiple problems. The report does not have a category for traumatic brain injury, but it does include post-traumatic stress disorder, mental disorders, infectious and parasitic diseases, and ill-defined conditions.
Do you think of
You know, I'm going to stop that. The clip is much longer than I thought it was. I'm sorry. It didn't get to Jim Nicholson. But Nicholson basically said that most of these vets are showing up for dental services.
Yes, he did.
Did he say that?
They were talking about the two sets of books. Department of Defense has 23,000 wounded, yet the VA has treated over 205,000 vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And Bob Woodward listed off a whole list of problems that these troops have had, including traumatic brain injury. And Nicholson looked him right in the eye and said, oh, yeah, and some are there for dental care as well. Woodruff, but what's even a greater point here, Tom, is that Bob Woodruff came back and said, but these people are in the VA system because of problems they've developed during the wars. Isn't that correct? Nicholson's answer was, it's possible.
It's incredible. I mean, this is mind-boggling.
It's absolutely incredible, the arrogance and the denial of this man. And I want to tell you something else. This, and this has slipped by a lot of people, in an absolutely cynical move, also in that interview, it was pointed out that the VA did not have a systematic approach to diagnosing and treating traumatic brain injuries, the signature wound of this war. Just a few hours before this program aired yesterday, because the VA knew it was going to be bad news, Secretary Nicholson issued a press release called VA Leading the Way in Care for Traumatic Brain Injury, another example of VA adapting to the needs of newest veterans. He announced just hours before this program aired that they're going to be setting up traumatic brain injury care units at all 155 VA medical centers. In other words, they were trying to head off this bad news. We have two problems here, Tom. One, the troops can't wait, and this takes time. Two, the VA doesn't have the money to do this. To be able to train the personnel, to get the equipment, and to set up these traumatic brain injury care units all across the country, the VA is going to have to siphon off funds from some other part of the healthcare budget. This is going to mean other veterans are going to wait, they're going to be at longer waiting lists, and they're going to be delayed healthcare, there's going to be denied healthcare. An absolutely cynical thing this man did yesterday.
For the benefit of our listeners who are not regular listeners to the show, because you're a regular guest here, Larry, and I think most of our listeners have heard your riff on this, but we've picked up a lot of stations in the last few weeks. Who is Jim Nicholson, and how did he get to be head of the Veterans Administration?
Jim Nicholson, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, made his mark politically as the chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was the number one drum banger when it came to the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. As we know, he was successful in that effort, okay? He is a loyalist. He is a party loyalist. He is a George W. Bush loyalist. He is an ideologue, period, end of subject. When George W. Bush was elected to his first term, Jim Nicholson was then appointed as ambassador to the Vatican. One of his main goals was eradicating world hunger, which sounds awfully good, doesn't it? Until you look at what he's written about it, his concept is to take genetically modified organisms, GMOs, into all the third world countries. So what you'd end up with is you'd end up with companies like ADM owning all the food in poor third world countries. That's another one of his goals. That's the man, and he's a danger to veterans, Tom, plain and simple.
A political hack running the Veterans Administration.
That's the nicest thing you can say.
Yeah. Larry Smith. Head of VAWatchdog.org. Check out that website. It's great. Larry, thanks. All right, Larry Scott. Larry, thanks for being with us today, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go by drop by TomHartman.com. And Ron in Breezewood, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Well, man, I just love your sincerity. I mean, I've listened to your show now only about five times, but every time I just know, you know, it's from your heart that you're talking, man. And that just means a lot to a blue-collar worker who's been displaced at least five times, and now I'm a truck driver, and the Mexicans are going to come in and take over my job next. So,
ouch.
You know,
yeah.
This is
Bush's new plan. Up until now, it was only legal for Mexican drivers to bring their trucks 20 miles inside the United States. Now they can take them to Bangor, Maine, if they want.
Well, and then I just heard today, too, the, the people who guard our borders, they're responsible for once the Mexicans come into this country, how far they can actually drive their trucks anywhere they want to. And they are going to push a policy, what I heard today was, to eliminate any limitations on Mexicans once they come into this country.
No, that's my point. That's my point. They can drive all the way to Bangor, Maine. They can do anything. So the American trucking companies that are employing folks like you, Ron, will lay off guys like you. They'll go down to Mexico. They'll buy a Mexican trucking company. They'll pay these guys a buck and a half an hour because that's pretty good wages for a Mexican trucker. And they've got different safety standards for the trucks. They don't cost as much to maintain. And they'll just bring them across the border and boom, off you go. It's a guest worker program through the back door.
Yeah, it was going to be, you know, I mean, the original policy is 100 companies coming in and just, you know, being able to deliver, like you say, wherever their load would take them and then going back across the border. But with this new idea they're coming across with the Bush's idea is even once they're in our country, they can deliver our loads anywhere they want.
This is just another attempt to bust the Teamsters Union, in my opinion. Is that what you called about, Ron?
No, I wanted to ask you, in history, do you know, because the Republicans always throw this up to us, do you know of anywhere in history that I can use as an example, like France or something, where when our trade deficit got so high, or our country's trade deficit got so high, that it backfired on the country? Because that's what they're supporting everything, is our exported jobs and everything is based on, it's not going to hurt us. Service economy in this country will not hurt our economy whatsoever. We can support our lifestyles and everything with just the service economy. Where I believe, like you do, we need an industrial policy. And I just wonder if history, because they always throw it up to us, if there's any example you know.
Yeah, the history of any banana republic. I mean, literally, they called them banana republics because we, you know, we would go in and buy the land and grow the bananas and export them. We colonized. This is economic colonization, basically. We colonized a lot of other countries in the 1900s, the 19th century, and the 20th century, and the 1900s. A lot of countries, there's a lot of blowback from that. I mean, in Nicaragua and Ecuador and arguably, I mean, you could go back to Dole Pineapple and what they were doing in Hawaii, you know, before it was a state. And so there's no shortage of examples. Just, I mean, look around the world at banana republics, at third world countries that have been economically.
There is no real industrial base in them countries, so I see where you're coming from.
Right, and basically what happens is those countries become sources of raw materials, and consumers of finished goods. And that's what's happened in the United States. We are now the world's leading exporter of raw materials. We ship out of the United States iron ore. We ship out of the United States pulp paper. We ship out of the United States wood. We're shipping out of the United States trash, recycled paper and trash to China, where they manufacture paper boxes and ship it back to us with TV sets in them. I mean, we are the leading exporter in the world now of raw materials, which is the definition of a third world country, and we're the leading importer in the world, the consumer in the world, of finished goods. And it used to be just 26 years ago, when the day that Ronald Reagan came into office, it was the exact opposite. And this is the result of 26 years of Reaganomics. Ron, thanks for the call. I've got to move it along here. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, though. GDP, gross domestic product, or gross national product. Adbusters put together an ad a while ago, not include the cost of Richard Speck's rifle. It doesn't include the cost. This is just a very quick point about how we do our financial calculations in this country.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Which brings us back to this thing of, you know, the freedoms of the world and whatnot. They're, you know, constantly, well, it helps GDP, it increases GDP. Well, yeah, but that's not always a good thing. Every diagnosis of cancer increases GDP by $250,000. It generates economic activity. An oil spill increases GDP. Every time a hurricane increases GDP because things need to be rebuilt. Is that a good thing? Do you want to build a national policy on that? No. No. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. I spent the earlier part of this morning watching Ben Bernanke in front of Congress today.
And oh, I watched C-SPAN.
Yes. And I watched one conservative Republican after another frame and then illustrate, you know, paint by numbers their personal agenda of the problems of the economy. And they were, the problems were the pensions. The problems were Medicare. The problem was Social Security. And I'm like, well, when is somebody going to put this all together and just come out and say that the problem is old people? And it's sarcastic.
But see, that's not the problem, Dave. The problem is that the wealth of old people has been squandered.
I'm being sarcastic. And,
okay. All right. Okay.
And I would say, you know, what are they proposing? We either deal with this or we have a Logan's Run kind of solution.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, I was in Africa about 15, 20 years ago, and in, I think it was Nigeria. They triple booked, the national airline had triple booked a 747. They had three times as many people. And so the pilot said everybody has to run around the plane three times, and the first people after three times around the plane to end up at back at the door get to come in. and this is like a variation on that. I mean, that's how, you know, this is like, that's the Bush plan for you know, for as people age, you know.
If you, or how about make it, one grandparent, you can choose. If you're a coupled family with children, you can choose one grandparent. The rest go to euthanasia.
Yeah, see, this is where it gets so weird, because what, with regard to Social Security, somebody mentioned this earlier, and I guess now is as good a time as any to just lay this out so everybody gets it. Social Security, which was created in 1935, 1936, was always a pay-as-you-go program. That is to say, the current generation of workers was paying for the retirement of the previous generation. If Social Security had enough people that they needed $100 million to pay out benefits, then the Social Security tax was fixed at $100 million. And so the current workers were paying enough. And Social Security wasn't accruing surpluses, and it wasn't accruing losses. They would just adjust the tax every year so that, you know, it was always paying that out. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, it became obvious that there was this bulge going to be going through the snake, through the python, this rabbit through the python of the baby boomers. And that when the baby boomers started to retire in 2012, 2015, something like that, that there was going to be such a large number of people retiring that the increase in the Social Security tax would have to be quite dramatic. Instead of being 6 or 7%, it would have to go up to 15, 18, 20%, and that would just be too much to be practical. So the Alan Greenspan and Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a few other people got together during the first year of the Reagan administration, and they had this Moynihan Commission, the Moynihan-Greenspan Commission, and they said, we have a solution to this problem. Let's have the baby boomers, those people born between basically the end of World War II and about 1955, 1960, I don't know what the parameters are, but let's have the baby boomers, those people, not only pay for their parents' retirement, but also let's have them pay for their own retirement. In other words, we're going to double the tax on Social Security now, so we don't have to quadruple it in 20 years. And they did. Ronald Reagan signed into law the largest tax increase in the history of the United States, doubling the Social Security tax from plus more or less 7% up to around 14%. About half of it's paid by us, half by our employers. And the surplus that we started paying in 1980, the generation that would retire in 2012, that we started paying in 1980, that surplus was supposed to be used to pay off our retirement. And it would have worked. Except that then Reagan did Reaganomics, and he spent, you know, he cut the taxes on everybody, and he ran out of money, had this huge budget deficit. He says, what do I do? Greenspan says, borrow it from Social Security. It'll be off budget. Nobody will know you're doing it. You can run a deficit. You can make it look like Reaganomics works, and nobody will realize that you're stealing the money of the boomers because, you know, it's going to be 20 years before anybody notices this. And here we are.
One of the funnier moments today with Bernanke was one of the Republican congressmen tried to get Bernanke to say that even FDR borrowed from the Social Security Fund.
And
that was a bit of a...
I'm assuming Bernanke did not say that.
No, he did a song and dance around it. He didn't basically, you know, I'm sure he was thinking this guy's an idiot and would have liked to say so, but he couldn't do it.
Yeah, Because there was no trust fund, first of all, back then.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's like
the Social Security.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. God bless you. That's great. That was a good one. Man, because the Social Security Trust Fund was created to double tax one generation and one generation only. And then by 2030 or so, it was supposed to go away. And Reagan spent it, and Bush spent it, and Clinton spent it. And now Bush is spending it again. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
66-302-2070. Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we do acknowledge that Roosevelt is dead, but we do think he also had some good ideas. We rather disagree with Mr. Limbaugh when he says...
Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
No, we'd really like to kind of keep some of those policies. Unemployment insurance, Social Security, it just seems like a good idea. Andrew in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi. Gosh, I'm flattered I'm on this quick. I had a question about privatization and capital going across borders without as many restrictions. I'm sure some countries do have restrictions or may still have.
Virtually every country, yeah.
May still have restrictions on private capital going back and forth. Now, I met people involved in industry who are heavily invested in China, and they manufacture goods to be sold in Home Depot or other tool stores, basically. And
I see what you're saying. Let me clarify. There are very few restrictions on international capital movement. I mean, that's the thing. If you as a human being want to go from here to China, for example, you're going to have to get permission from China to go there. You're going to have to get permission from the United States to return. In other words, you're going to have a passport. They're going to check all these kind of. But capital, if a corporation wants to move money around, no big deal.
Right. So we are heavily invested in Chinese industry from what all accounts.
Although the Chinese do limit how we can invest. Usually, typically, you have to do business with a Chinese company or you have to have a Chinese partner.
Okay. Yeah. So, all this talk about, China can just, stop us from going to war in one country or another, like Iran, and by just, they clamp down on our, they can sell off all their treasury notes or whatever it is that they own. Well, how much influence does our private capital have to deter them from doing that? And, I'm not advocating that they dump our stock or, I don't want to be in a depression necessarily, but.
Neither do I. I honestly don't know the answer to the question. My guess is that because so much of the private capital that's floating around the world is institutional. It's like, giant pension funds, the investments of states, the investments of universities, the corporate pension funds, things like that. So much of it is institutional, where you get a whole bunch of stocks together, mutual funds.
Mutual.
So much of the international capital right now is institutional that I don't think that there's any one individual. I doubt that Warren Buffett, has the power to do something like that. You had George Soros, who was accused of precipitating a currency crisis in the Far East long ago. I'm not sure whether he played a role in it or whether he simply took advantage of it. But even that was with, relatively small countries like Thailand and small amounts of currency. So, no, I frankly, I don't know the answer, but my guess is that that's not either going to be the risk to us or the salvation of us, that we're looking at large corporations being able to do some substantial harm, but the largest harm would be done by entire governments, like the government of China. You know, that the, that threat of China to pull the plug, I think it's a very real one. Bill in Vashon Island, you wanted to make an announcement about something, Bill.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for taking my call. The Backbone Campaign is sponsoring a national day of dialogue, action, and celebration this Sunday, March 4th. March 4th is a fun play on words, but it's also the day that the Constitution went into effect in 1789. So we've got events for everywhere from Florida to California to Georgia to Wichita, and big events in Seattle, where we, and the one in Seattle, our flagship event, we're going to, I don't want to say suspend the Constitution because it already feels like that's been done, but we have built a 20-foot by 50-foot Constitution preamble that we're going to invite participants to sign, and then we're going to process that out of the space, and it will begin a nationwide tour inviting people to embrace the idea that it's we the people we're going to create a more perfect union in this country.
That's great, Bill, and I'm assuming that's backbonecampaign.com?
It's backbonecampaign.org or
.org.
Or wethepeoplemarchforth.org, and people can access a map where they can see events that are happening in their area, or they can host a cocktail party at their own house. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to make it an annual event.
Very, very good. Thanks a lot for the heads up, Bill. I appreciate it. Jim in Burbank, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, thanks for talking about the the immigration issue, which is the inequality between free movement of capital versus humans across the face of this planet.
Yeah, see, I think my take on that is not that we should be that we should do away with national borders with regard to citizenship, but that we should perhaps enhance national borders with regard to the movement of capital.
But well, my main call was about the unions.
Yeah.
The unions. I'm thinking about the need for unions. And why? What if we finally get the government to represent the regular people in this country? Then we wouldn't need to have another institution that can be hijacked by somebody like Jimmy Hoffa, or hijacked like the way our government's been hijacked by so many corporations.
Yeah, you know, it sounds nice, Jim, and Jimmy Hoffa was a corrupt guy, the elder, and a shame it was, but he got nailed for it. I mean, you know, but the reality is that government is not going to represent working people as well as working people can represent working people. And unions are actually democracies. They're democratic institutions. It's democracy in the workplace. That's what a union is. And that's why they're so important. And because of the power of combined capital, they can only exist in the face of government. Like the Wagner Act, making them legal. Tomorrow on Friday, I'll be broadcasting live from the Conservative Union Foundation Radio Row in Washington, D.C., with Grover Norquist, Richard Vegery, Bob Barr. On Friday, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders will be here with us. That and more in your calls on the Tom Hartman program coming up. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.